This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. So for Black History Month, this episode, we're going to switch things up a little bit in the best way. Last week, I had a conversation with the hosts of WBEZ's When Magic Happens podcast. The show brings together different generations of Black women to get different perspectives on living life across eras. And for this conversation, we got into where we're all coming from when we think about celebrating this month. As it turns out, we are quite different in how we think about it. But there were some significant through lines as well. For one, we all agree that Black history is actually now. It's the things Black people in all our diasporic diversity do every day to survive and to thrive. This conversation originally went out on the When Magic Happens podcast last week, and we're bringing it to the Rundown feed so you can hear it today with me and When Magic Happens co-hosts Cheryl Jackson and Taylor Coward.
How do you celebrate Black History Month or honor this time?
You know, I'm more of a passive Black History Month celebrator. Mm-hmm. I feel like always I was in school and there was some programming or special curriculum, or like at work, you know, somebody would be doing something special. So I just kind of go along with it.
Yeah.
Usually. But yeah, I just feel like this is something that comes up a lot. But, you know, I just kind of am Black all year, and I think about Blackness all year. I think about white supremacy all year. You know, I think about being a Black person who has a bunch of different other identities, too, all year. And that's the dynamism of Blackness that is like always coming up for me, I feel like.
Cheryl, what about you?
I don't know if you know this about me, but I was the CEO of the Chicago Urban League, which is a civil rights organization. So, you know, from that role on, I've had a much more, you know, proactive sort of expression of celebrating Black History Month than maybe I typically would have had. But I've long since been gone from that role. And now I get invitations to speak, you know, at various programs. I look for programs. My mother is a history maker unto herself, so I'm always supporting her as she's being celebrated. And I asked to speak during the month of February, my mother being a composer. As a matter of fact, her latest work, she's a classical choral music composer of sacred works, but her latest work is an oratorio celebrating the life of Harriet Tubman. Hmm. So on February 11th, it's being premiered in Memphis with the National Civil Rights Museum and the Memphis Symphony Orchestra. So I feel like February is a busy month for me.
So I'm hearing that Black history is 365. Our Black History Month celebrations don't stop.
Yeah. You know, you be on social, and there's always these really great memes.
Yes.
You know, people talking about, let a white person, you know, say something to me this month, you know, or like whatever. That's always funny.
Do you know what? I was partaking in a lot of Juneteenth memes last year.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And my contribution was, where in what group chat did everybody order their little flags for their car that I was left out of?
Oh.
Because did you notice that every Black person in Chicago had a Juneteenth flag?
I noticed.
Or
that.
Just the Pan-African flag.
Damn, I
Pan-African
missed
flag.
Even the meeting where people were noticing.
Okay, well, that meeting was a solo meeting of me where I was driving and feeling very left out because I was like, oh, so where was the Amazon link? Like,
okay.
So this year I'm getting a little holder, and I'm gonna stick it in my car window because Cheryl, I don't want to keep being left out of that. So
I know. Well, you know, the DeSavo Museum hosts a big celebration around Juneteenth, so yeah. I'll be sure and flag you for that one.
Oh, thank you. Let me know. You know, that has me thinking. During Black History Month, is there an event that you've been to that you really enjoyed or that kind of stood out to you?
That's a good question.
Because I used to go on Martin Luther King Day to the DuSable Museum, and they would play movies and you'd learn a lot. You'd have snacks. You'd meet people. And that was really enjoyable. So maybe I want to find something this month to go to if y'all have any.
Yeah, a friend of the show, also Adora Namika Day, she does some reporting. I noticed she's done the last couple of years about some Black history happenings in the city of Chicago. I will say one thing that I can never forget that always comes to my memory is that we would always have, my elementary school was May C. Jemison Academy in Detroit, represent, okay. Represent for Chicago also, because May C. Jemison. And it was a blackety-black school in a blackety-black city. And it, you know, we would always celebrate Kwanzaa and we would do, you know, so many different African-American traditions. And during Black History Month, we always had an assembly where students would get up and read different poems by Black poets and just recite things. And we would sing the Black National Anthem together. And it was just such unity at a time when I didn't even understand necessarily the significance of it.
Yeah.
I read the poem, I Am the Black Child.
Okay.
I don't remember who that was by or what the words were,
but
we got into it. And, you know, it was always, I am the Black child. You know, it was like a very passionate MLK type, you know, reading. It was almost like we were in a competition of who was going to say am, you know, the hardest.
I love that.
Win that Oscar.
Exactly.
Go full Viola.
Start early.
I think those school projects and like school plays and school performances during Black History Month are so, they're like the foundation for you to grow on. And so I would hope that in schools now they're still having that happen. Because in elementary school, we always had a Black History Month project. And I remember one night I got up at like 1 a.m. to go get water. And you best believe a trifold of Harriet Tubman was staring down at me. And I forgot. Heart attack.
Okay, Harriet, she had a strong face.
Strong gaze.
Yes, she was very, like, strong in her gaze and in her facial expression.
Imagine that, going to get a midnight snack.
Yeah.
But I remember those things, and I remember the research that went into it and being excited of using rubber cement and pasting all these figures, and it just was really, really fun. And I also think that if you teach people young, it keeps that excitement going rather than finding out as an adult about Black history, like foundational Black history, and then being ashamed. But I still think there's things I'm learning now that are brand new.
Yeah.
There will always be something to learn. You know, like, oh, thank you for inventing this thing, Black woman.
Right, right. That's always cool to find out things that Black people pioneered or contributed to. You know, growing up, I don't know about you guys, but growing up, we had the Negro almanac. Did you? I mean, that was like a staple, this big, thick book in our house.
Can you tell us?
Describe it. Paint the picture, because I didn't have this.
Growing comb.
Oh, yeah. I actually have a copy from, this one copy must be early 70s or late 60s, but it's a thick book, and it just basically attempts to, you know, tell the history of Black Americans. Mm. And it's called the Negro Almanac. And so it's just A to Z, what our history, our past, from enslavement to Jim Crow to civil rights, contributions, pioneers. It was just a staple in our house.
Wow.
So we have that as a foundational, you know, even back then, my parents did not rely on the public education system to teach about Black History Month. Yeah. And so here we are. Before, it was just like an omission, like just they didn't teach it. Now it's just incorrect information.
And actively trying to remove what is there.
Yeah.
Correct. Revised. Correct. To your point, Taylor, unlike the Dr. Martin Luther King Day, you know, there is, like in Chicago at least, a quintessential event. It's put on by Rainbow Push and Reverend Jackson. His annual scholarship fund event starts at 7:30 in the morning on the holiday that commemorates Dr. Martin Luther King, his birthday. And everybody knows that. Everybody's like there, from bigwigs, the names, to everyday people. Don't necessarily have that signature event in the month of February. So there's a lot, you know, everybody's doing lots of different things, but which is great. I'd like for us, we just got to, you know, as a community, just, you know, double down and elevate our game on being intentional about teaching our history to everybody.
Cheryl, did you go to elementary school here or in the South?
I was in the South. I was in Memphis until through high school. Yes.
Okay. I'm kind of curious. Growing up in the South, what was it like in elementary school, high school, learning about Black history?
I remember my mother telling the story of my, I wasn't in school yet, but my brother, who's 2 years older than me, he came home and he, you know, was so excited. He was telling my mother, he's like, you know, Mom, he's like, did you know about this girl who sat on this bus and she wouldn't get moved, you know, give up her seat? And this girl was amazing. And he was referring to Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. but and my mother retells that story. But personally, at my school, I, you know, surely I know there was, but it was not something that was, that left an impression on me.
Did you have Black teachers?
Most of my teachers were not Black.
Okay. I think that makes
there
a big difference.
Yes. I recall one teacher. I mean, I went to a school, my high school was called White Station. And then I was at an all-girls Catholic school.
White Station?
White Station. There you go. Mic dropped. And we were the first wave of integration.
Right.
And so...
Thank you for your service, Cheryl. Honestly, like, I just...
I'm like, not Cheryl being a hidden figure, exactly. Having to integrate the school. I remember when she told me that the first time, I was like, you did who now? At the what
did
now?
What?
Yeah.
So they bussed in kids. So we weren't eligible for the bussing in part, the bussing by kids in. We came to the school through the special advanced academics and was, we were able to opt in. And we were the first, so that number was even smaller. Mm-hmm. Of Black kids coming into the gifted programs. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot. I remember my brother, somehow we broke barriers and able to do things. My brother became the president of the student council. And he was the first Black person ever to be president of the student council.
Oh,
but
right.
But there was a lot, you know, that you had to deal with and face.
Yeah.
The teachers, they weren't my teachers. For my classes, but they were advocates for me and my siblings. All of us, all five of us went to White Station.
Wow. When you talked about how your brother came home and was like, oh my gosh, have you heard of this Rosa Parks lady?
Right.
This
girl. Do you remember who that person was for you?
You know, so much of the historical figures that we are taught to honor are usually men. And it's his story, right, is a lot of the history that we get. You know, I mean, like I said, I went to Macy Jemison Academy, right? Like that, and baby is still alive. You know, that's another one, right? She got her flowers back in the early 90s by that school and by a lot of ways, you know, while she was still living. And she was a person, she actually would come and visit our school once a year. And yeah, I mean, it was fire. She like I've met her as a child, you know, but I think like to meet her today, I would just, you know, just have to share so much gratitude.
Yeah.
And to her and to the principal of that school, Dr. Shelby Hopkins, who named the school after her and who led that school with grace and style and expertise that so far I've seen unmatched at a school such as that. But those are two people who I really looked up to and just felt so honored and privileged to know about and to be able to spend time around. You know, including all the amazing Black people in my family who are just lovely.
What about you, Taylor?
Mine would probably be learning about Mahalia Jackson in school.
Mm-hmm.
Because I lived in Bronzeville at the time. And during the Great Migration, Bronzeville is where she landed when she got up north. And how connected she was to kind of my grandmother and my grandmother's love for gospel. And it just was so exciting to learn about this person that changes things and is a tastemaker and a trailblazer that can be from your own backyard and is also Black.
Yes.
And I had to acknowledge even then that I was in a bubble and that Chicago does grant you the opportunity to be around so many powerful, beautiful, impactful Black people, but not everybody has that.
I think Erin hit on something I hadn't really thought about, mm-hmm. that most of my teachers, or all of them, were white.
Wow.
The principal, the teachers, everybody was predominantly white. Mm. So, yes, I read the stories from Memphis. You get the basics, and certainly about Dr. King and the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say that my soul didn't really fully awaken to it until my freshman year in college. Why? Because of a certain professor. On Northwestern's campus, there's a center for African-American students called the Black House. And
from the white station to the Black House.
White station to the Black House. Okay. And it was, the confluence of both the executive director of the Black House and that experience where it was like very pro-Black was like new for me. And Reverend Jesse Jackson was running for president, and he spoke at the convention floor of the DNC that summer. Mm. And I remember being in our living room on the floor, lying on the floor in my stomach, watching the TV with my entire family. We were all glued to the TV to hear Reverend Jackson's speech. And I was just awakened. My mm-hmm. soul was awakened. And it was so powerful. I started writing to my professor, like giving him my thoughts of the speech. And I was asking so many questions about the political process and Black people. It was that moment that I fully awoke to the weight of what it meant to be Black in America.
Mm. Wow.
Shout out to the educators.
Yes. They make a difference. Yes. They are the difference. So we've been talking about Black history as in past historical figures, but what about Black history is now? What does that mean to you? That Black history is now, as in right now.
It means that we're still having a lot of firsts as Black people,
ooh.
Which is very, it shows how much we persevere, but it also shows how tough this world is on us, that we are still doing things in 2024 for the very first time. And so despite whatever pressures are out there against us, we still make strides. And so when I think of contemporary Black history, I think of the Issa Raes, the Quinta Brunsons, the Michelle Obamas. I think of the people here making this podcast. And I just think of, wow, like, despite it all, we still show up and we still shine. Every day we do things that are just history making. And you would think by now there are things that, would have been recognized already. I don't know. It just seems like we're still getting recognized for things that we've been doing for a while.
Oh, Exhibit A, Claudine Gay, the first Black woman president of Harvard.
Mm.
It's not just even becoming the first. You think, okay, the doors are open, just walk through it. You walk through it and you have to fight.
Yeah.
Fight. It's the continual fight that can be so dispiriting.
Yeah.
And so when you look at Claudine Gay, she was the first Black woman president of Harvard University, only in that seat for 6 months before they targeted her and took her out.
Yeah, the nitpicking, nitpicking.
Yes. So anyway, it's you're right. Who are the modern day? What are their struggles and their fights? They're, unfortunately, they're still first, and there's still a whole lot of fighting.
Yes. Do y'all feel like are we making history? Can we say that as Black podcast hosts?
I believe so. here in this space, like to look like you can go to WBZ Chicago online on the NPR podcast app, and you will see so many black female faces hosting podcasts or hosting radio shows.
Yes.
I think that is like magnificent. And I don't know if you look back in history, if that would be the case for, I don't know, for media in general, like to see so
like
many
who's in the front.
Yeah. To see so many black women whose voices are being amplified and are given a platform. I think that that is pretty, dare I say, history.
So like we are a part of the story of black people, black women in media.
I believe
at this time, this new media.
Yes. Don't
that
you
we're
think?
Making.
What do you think?
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. But I do like that aspect of how we all contribute to history making milestones.
Yeah.
And in this, it does feel like this space of hearing more from black people's voices, and you know, specifically black women. It, you know, we haven't been in this space long.
Yeah.
You're hearing the stories and the voices of black women. And that very much, I think, is, you know, history making. So yeah, I think I agree. What I, you know, we often, Ebony Magazine was known for doing stories, especially cover stories, but if you were the first, the only, you know, the first and the only, and you know, that's pretty much a lot of their stories were shaped by that experience. And we celebrate that when a black person makes history, you know, breaks a ceiling, a glass ceiling. But I just want us to acknowledge the pain and the battles and the sacrifices that go along with being the first. There's a whole lot of pain behind that.
Yeah, and, I mean, yeah.
And we can look at Claudine Gay as
exactly
a fresh example of that.
Yep, and Misty Copeland. I listened to an interview by her, interview with her, and, you know, she talked about that too. I mean, there's the pressure to feel like you have to betray yourself and your body and what comes natural to you in order to perform, right? In order to go above and beyond to show that, you know, you belong where you are. You know, she talked about that a lot. And it really, it's such a complicated ambivalence, a dynamic ambivalence that we have, you know, Cheryl, to your point, like when we are the first, right, we're so happy to break through. But then, you know that that's going to, you know what you had to go through to get there, right?
What was the cost? What
exactly.
Was the cost?
And then you know that you might have to keep paying that cost in order to stay there. And then
absolutely.
And then even hearing the story as a person who's not in it, right? As a black person who hears a story, you're like, yes, that person broke through. But then the ambivalence comes in again where you're just like, that's good, but that's not good.
Right. Right.
Right.
You know?
It's double-edged.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, a rejoice and an eye roll at the same time.
I'm no Claudine Gay or Misty Copeland, but my career has been shaped by being the first in so many occasions, you know, the first black person and first woman, you know, as the communications director for a sitting governor, the first to serve in the C-suite of corporation. And I'm here to tell you, it is painful, and you, it leaves scars. But if it makes it easier for more black people, not only to, you know, be in that space, but to be in that space in such a brilliant way, because they aren't fighting the same fights that I had to fight, they can spend that energy and focus on just being their most brilliant selves, that it makes it worth its while. So it's really, you know, the times that we find ourselves living in of having sliding back, you know, whether it's, you know, voting rights, you know, the dismantling of diversity programs, mm-hmm. the dismantling of DEI, dismantling of that. And you just feel this kind of sliding back. We're fighting the same stuff that historically we've already fought those battles. And here we are fighting them again.
And in those difficult moments or even after, as you debrief, right, as being, you know, a first and having those scars, you know, mm-hmm. that you were thinking about the next generation, about passing the baton, like, do you feel like that was coming up as a comfort for you in the real time?
I think that probably not in real time. Real time is about survival. Mm. You're just in surviving mode. You know, I think upon reflection, particularly when you are counting up the costs, like what did this cost me to be here, to make it? And you're looking to understand it, then the ultimate sort of balm, healing balm, is knowing that you're making it easier for the next generation.
So Cheryl, what are you most proud of when it comes to being a part of Black history?
That I showed up. I withstood. I was there.
Yeah.
And I just, yeah. sometimes the power is just in standing. It's not so much about what did you do? What were the outcomes? But that I showed up and I stood. What about you?
It's not
a trailblazer.
as a
breaking
celebrity.
Barriers.
Oh, stop. It takes a lot of courage. You know, I was a kid who was bullied. You know, I never thought of myself of having a lot of courage. But in this department, I think I do. You know, I feel like it's not easy to go and do the thing that you like to do mm-hmm. and try to do that full time, you know, for a living.
And well.
Thank you, Taylor. You're and welcome. Will. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not easy to look inside yourself and really say, like, what is it that I'm here to do? And then once you find that, go ahead and do it. You right. know, it sounds simple, but it's not. And we get a lot of people talking us out of doing that, mm-hmm. Especially if you're a creative person. And so, yeah, I would say that that's one thing that I'm proud of. What about you?
I'm proud of your courage. I really am. And I think you're right. That's what it really takes, is courage. A whole lot of it.
Oh. Yeah. How about you, Taylor? What are you proud of as a Black woman making history?
I'm proud to be someone my age, like, doing things that maybe haven't been done yet. Like, I feel proud that I'm on this show. Like, I don't know how many other 24-year-olds have a show at BEZ. And I just am proud to be here, and I'm proud of where I'll go, you know, and what I'll learn. And that, yeah, just to have this platform is something that I'm proud of.
Mm-hmm.
I aspire to give other young people voices and platforms since I was given that.
Oh, see, that's what it's all about.
And that's it for today. Thank you to Justin Bull and Sarah Stark for producing The Rundown, and to Ariel Van Cleve and Katie O'Connell for editing the show. Brianna Garrett produces When Magic Happens, and Brendan Banizak is the executive producer for both shows. Ethan Schwab and Maria Lopez engineered this episode. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. I'm Erin Allen. Happy Black History Month. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.